The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The thing that I think Apple might be thinking is that this is going to get the government off their backs. Look, we gave you what you want. Now, like, this is the thing that you keep hammering on us about. Now we've done it. Go away. It's not. Now it's going to be, they're all going to be wanting one. And it's not, as I said, going to be limited to CSAM. So I don't think Apple has succeeded in deflecting attention away, even though there is also now attention being paid to the Facebooks and the Googles and the Signals of the world. It's going to be paid on Apple too, and the demand is going to be to do more and more and more. You can't give an inch without a mile being snatched away.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 13th, 2021. Two of the biggest controversies in tech are how to stop the spread of child pornography and other exploitation material, and whether encryption prevents legitimate law enforcement investigations, and if so, what to do about it. In an announcement last week, Apple dropped a bomb into both of these debates. Apple announced that future versions of its iPhone operating system would scan photos its users posted to the cloud and automatically detect if those photos contain child exploitation material. And if so, Apple would notify the government. While many in law enforcement and in organizations devoted to child safety have hailed Apple's announcement, it has proven hugely controversial among many technologists, security researchers, and digital civil society advocates. They worry that Apple's system will harm privacy and civil rights, especially if governments demand that it be used to scan for content other than child exploitation. To help make sense of this all, I was joined by Mayank Varia, a cryptographer at Boston University, and Rihanna Pfeffercorn, a research scholar at the Stanford Internet Observatory. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 13th. Mayank Varia and Rihanna Pfeffercorn on Apple's decision to scan for child exploitation material. So, Mayank, will you start us off with a description of what exactly it is that Apple announced, and at a high level, how this scanning works and what its limits are?
Yeah, so I'll start by discussing it at sort of a from just a technological standpoint. What are the computer science and cryptographic systems that they put together? And I'm sure we'll have more time to talk about the law and policy implications of that later. So I'll stick to the technology for now. The white paper that Apple put on their website last week about child safety it's kind of a complicated system that has a bunch of moving pieces. The way I think of it is there's four very discrete parts, and then they all fit together at the end. So the problem at its core from a computer science standpoint is, Apple or NCMEC has a set of images. Your phone has a bunch of images, your phone or laptop or whatever, has a bunch of images that you're going to upload to the cloud. And Apple would like to know if many of the images are in the intersection of the NCMEC set.
And just interrupt, just for those of our listeners who may not be aware, NCMEC is the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. It's this kind of quasi-public-private organization that has a big database of child exploitation materials and is responsible for collecting that information from platforms as they detect child exploitation materials and then forwarding that onto law enforcement. So that's just for everyone to be on the same page. That's what NCMEC is.
Yes, thanks. So basically, once there are these images, there's sort of four moving pieces. The first one is something called perceptual hashing, which is a fancy term for saying trying to extract a feature of the image that does not change too much, you know, if the image is just like brightened or cropped or you make some minor, you know, Photoshop edit to it. Conceptually, it's very simple. Actually, building this is probably one of the hardest pieces of what Apple is proposing to do. And at the moment, it's a giant black box because they haven't released any details about how this part works. So I'm sure we'll come back to that later. But basically, you take these images and you sort of build a canonical version of the image that is invariant to these kinds of Photoshop transformations. The second piece is something called private set intersection cardinality. That's a fancy word of saying how many things do we have in common? So how many of those images from the Apple/NCMEC data set and from your set of stuff that you're uploading to iCloud are in common? Apple will learn how many of these pieces, how many photos are in common in the intersection of these two sets. The third piece is something called threshold encryption or threshold decryption. And what that means is if a lot of them are in common, if some greater than some threshold number of images are in common, then Apple actually has a way of recovering the secret key material in order to decrypt those images, to read the images that are in the intersection. But not the other images on your device. And the fourth piece is just like an obfuscation piece that basically says if the number of images you have is relatively small, they want to try to obscure the number of how many, if it's less than that threshold, if it's not enough for Apple to read your images, then they want to obscure how many elements overlap. So each of these four pieces sort of fits together in their white paper. Most of the cryptographic stuff in the white paper is not really that new. It's cryptography that has been studied for a very long time. The new parts are the beginning piece, that perceptual hashing is, like I said before, it's brand new and it's a total black box. We don't know how it works. There are some novelties in the final piece about how to do this obfuscation piece at the end. But the real novelty, I think, is the fact that Apple put these pieces together. Both from a technological point of view, there's a bunch of engineering, plumbing, and glue to make the pieces fit together, but really mostly from a policy perspective that there's a company willing to put these pieces together.
So a couple of follow-up questions before I turn to Rihanna and ask, you know, why Apple decided to do this. So the first question is, so you mentioned just now that the perceptual hashing algorithm is a quote-unquote black box. We don't know how it operates. And I'm curious, do we expect that to change? Do we expect Apple to release either partial or perhaps the full information about how this algorithm works? And the reason I ask that is because my understanding is that the best practices when it comes to computer security and cryptography is that, you know, all your ciphers, all your kind of cryptographic primitives, you always want those to be public so that the maximum number of people can look at them, stress test them, find flaws, and you have to design them in such a way such that they can be public, but still achieve the, you know, cryptographic goal, right? You don't want to, you know, roll your own crypto, as it were. I mean, is this what Apple is doing? Are they coming up with this perceptual hashing algorithm? And then they're just going to have to say, you know, trust us, this thing works. Or do we expect this to be, if not open source, then just to be made public in some way?
Yeah, good question. I'll address it from a few standpoints. First, I don't personally know whether Apple plans to make this open source at any time, either sooner or eventually. Perhaps you two might know. They have at least designed it from a threat model within Apple that it's a hash function that they're willing to make the code be something that resides client-side as compared to prior related systems such as Microsoft's PhotoDNA, which is broadly speaking trying to solve a similar problem, but Microsoft restricts the dissemination of that software so that it's only run on certain devices and not put on client-facing machines. So whether Apple plans to open source it or not, I don't know, but they're definitely taking into account the possibility of it being reverse engineered. But that leads into your final point, which is because this is a component of the system that crucially impacts the security of everything downchain from it. You know, if the hash system is broken and images that are either far apart look the same to this perceptual hashing feature, or images that are actually similar look very different, then everything I mentioned downstream of it sort of doesn't operate in the way that you would expect anymore. So it is actually incredibly security crucial to everything downstream that this piece works, which is why it's so important and why, you know, pretty much everybody in the in the scientific and civil liberties communities are pushing for this hash function to be made public, among many other requests.
Well, my other question, just about how the system works, is, you know, from my reading of Apple's materials and the commentary around it, it sounds like this scanning will only work if the user has enabled iCloud Sync. So iCloud is Apple's cloud service. You know, when you buy an iPhone, you can enable this feature and therefore have all your photos that you take on your iPhone uploaded to the cloud so you can access them later. And it sounds like Apple has designed the system such that only if there is iCloud syncing that the scanning will occur. So why does this limitation exist? And doesn't it make it very easy then to circumvent the scanning? If you just don't want it scanned, you can turn off iCloud, but that sort of seems to defeat the purpose of being really serious about finding CSAM.
So to your question of why it exists, I guess ultimately that might be a question for Apple more than any of us on the call, but in further intent from what they've built, the way they seem to be going about things is saying, you know, what you do on your device is your choice, but what you do on our servers is something that we want to scan. And so they want to be able to have the technological ability to scan all items uploaded to the Apple servers for the presence of CSAM. There are different ways that that could have been accomplished, and many other tech companies, broadly speaking, also do CSAM scanning, though in a very different way than what Apple is currently proposing. But I think that's sort of the demarcation that they're setting out in terms of, could this be trivially evaded? Yes, it could be trivially evaded by just turning off iCloud photos or using just local storage or just other service providers potentially. But I'll stress that that's an answer based on how the system works right now. And I suspect one thing we'll get into in this conversation is what doors this opens for how things might change in the future.
In other words, it is conceivable that Apple could at some point change the system and have it apply to all iPhones and all photos taken, whether or not the user decides to upload it to iCloud, which is to say that none of the technology that Apple has developed or put together, you know, kind of inherently relies on iCloud syncing. Is that a fair statement?
That's right. From a pure technological point of view, it would not be a very far lift to scan for all photos on your phone or laptop.
So, Rihanna, let me turn to you now, and let me ask, you know, what do you think explains Apple's decision to start this sort of scanning, and why are they doing it now? You know, I'm struck personally, and this is something I've written a lot about in my own research. Apple, of all the kind of tech, the big major tech companies, they've tended to be the most resistant to any sort of compromise or undermining, however you want to characterize it, of stronger end-to-end encryption. So, you know, most famously in 2016, they fought this incredibly high-profile battle with the FBI, which, you know, in some respects they won, in which they pushed back against the FBI's request that Apple write some custom code to help the FBI unlock one of the iPhones of one of the San Bernardino terrorist shooters. And in that situation, Apple took a very extreme or principled, again, however you want to characterize it, a stance saying that sort of under no circumstances should they be in the business of weakening encryption and allowing governments to circumvent it. Now, child exploitation is obviously a huge problem, but violent terrorism is also a really big problem. So what do you think accounts for this change in Apple's position?
Well, so I think that they have looming over them as do, you know, every other company that provides some form of either device encryption or communications encryption for their users, the looming threat that unless they throw the U.S. government a bone of some kind, that the U.S. government might just choose to outlaw strong encryption entirely. And we saw this threat get made by several senators during a hearing in December of 2019, at which Eric Neuenschwander from Apple, who has been very deeply involved in talking about and promoting these new features, was yelled at by multiple senators and told, you know, you have to come up with some way of fixing this child safety problem and fixing your encryption block of those issues, and you have to do better. Otherwise, we're going to do it for you. And so, you know, I think that also may help answer the why now question is, you know, if we assume that Eric flew home to Cupertino the next day from DC and said, I think they're serious, you guys, then that might have been the time when they may have started to work on this system, and it may have taken until now to get it ready for prime time and to be ready to announce it publicly. I don't think that was an idle threat on behalf of those senators, because a few months thereafter, we saw in rapid succession, first the introduction of the Earn It Act, which I've described as kind of a backdoor way of accomplishing a backdoor, in that it would have had potentially the impact of effectively getting rid of end-to-end encryption without actually overtly banning it. And then shortly after the Earn It bill was introduced, we saw the introduction of the Lawful Access to Encrypted Data Act bill by the same senator, Senator Graham, which would have simply basically been the end of strong encryption for devices and for communications in the United States, and also web encryption, even though that never actually seems to be a problem for investigators, because it would have amended both the, you know, the FISA side of American law and the criminal ECPA side of American law and, you know, warrant law, to mandate and specify that technical assistance can be demanded from providers such as Apple or Facebook or whoever in the form of providing a decryption of the data that they hold that the government is interested in. So I think that potential threat that we might just see a legal ban on basically all of Apple's business model for how they design the iPhone and for how they have designed iMessage, that might have been looming in the background there as Eminence Grease that led to this decision being made.
So Rihanna, let me continue with you. I mean, you are obviously, you know, in your position at Stanford and sort of generally, you are deeply enmeshed within the digital civil society organizations and community. And so what has the reaction, I mean, it's only been a few days, but what has the reaction been so far? And of course, you know, there's not one digital civil society, right? There are different groups and they have different concerns, and some are more concerned about privacy. Others maybe are more concerned about issues of child sexual exploitation or other harassment online. So, you know, across these different groups, what's been the initial response?
It's been dismay and shock, honestly. And part of that is because it's very clear that nobody was consulted by Apple at any point during this process. We can assume that they were working closely with NCMEC on this, because obviously they will depend upon getting that hash database from NCMEC. And presumably maybe also certain elements of law enforcement or other child safety organizations as well. But they never bothered talking to human rights organizations, even though, you know, there are organizations like the Human Rights Watch that have folks who think specifically about children's human rights and how encryption and the encryption battle interacts with those. It's clear they didn't talk to even moderate or centrist, you know, civil liberties type organizations, much less what the executive director of strategic partnerships at NCMEC unfortunately called the screeching minority in a letter to Apple that got leaked subsequently, and for which NCMEC has subsequently apologized in private. Nobody was consulted. And it's not just a vanity on our part that we didn't get brought in. It's also that, you know, it's actually pretty standard procedure when companies are designing some feature that they recognize has some privacy or speech or other impact. It's not unheard of. And in fact, it's pretty common practice to go around and sort of show them a demo and talk to them about it and get feedback. I've done that in the past while I've been at Stanford. And that way you can at least say, you know, we developed this in consultation with civil society stakeholders from across the spectrum. And it's really a glaring omission that none of that is here. As far as I can tell, this just got dropped as a fait accompli in everybody's laps without hearing any of the input that we are now out there talking about, which is, here are the ways that this may put, you know, queer and trans and questioning kids in danger on the messaging side of their announcement. And here are the international human rights, and here are the domestic civil liberties, and, you know, all of those related issues that are raised by the CSAM scanning to iCloud side of the announcement. So there's just been a lot of uproar. There's also honestly been a lot of confusion, because this is so surprising for a company that prides itself on really highly polished PR and, you know, really, you know, art of the spectacle, you know, circus-like presentations whenever they introduce a new iDevice, that Apple really misstepped here in terms of introducing this, you know, these new features to the general public. And it's very easy to conflate different parts of these two sides of the announcement. There's also a third side that nobody talks about because it's actually uncontroversial, involving a Syrian search. There's just been a lot of confusion about, wait, which ages for the messaging thing? What happens for which ages? Okay, and then wait, like what kind of, you know, hashing are you using on this side versus on this side of the announcement? And so they've also just not done a good job of explaining it. And so honestly, I'm glad that we have Mayank on here to just say like clearly in words that even I can understand what is actually going on in terms of what Apple is doing, because there's just been a lot of confusion as well. And so it's clear that they've spent the last week in, you know, damage control and sort of panicking and trying to explain more and have more meetings with members of civil society and of the press and issue more Q&As every day to try and explain better something that just, you know, was a really botched rollout for this.
So let me grant you that Apple could have done a better job with the PR on this. I guess my question for you is, what would have substantively changed if Apple had gone and done a roadshow, let's say, and consulted you and consulted other civil society groups? And let's stick to the CSAM scanning issue, because I think that's kind of the most controversial piece and is pretty separable from the other parts of what Apple has recently announced. You know, if civil society was always going to say, look, you shouldn't do this because whatever your intentions and however serious CSAM is as a problem, and no one disputes that, any attempt to weaken encryption or to, you know, create a quote unquote backdoor that will accomplish the same thing, you know, that's just a non-starter for us. So I guess my question is, you know, are you upset that you know Apple didn't kind of do the PR and the work to just signal this and give people time to prepare, or do you think that, you know, this would have materially been different or could have been materially different if they had actually consulted civil society? Because from their perspective, I can imagine them saying, look, we're going to get roasted on this either way, right? People are the people who don't like this are not going to like this, and there's nothing we can do about that. And so, you know, why bother letting them know a few weeks in advance and letting them, you know, get out in front of the thing we're going to do anyway and try to discredit it?
So I think that's a very nihilistic view, and it also misunderstands, well, not completely misunderstands, but is not necessarily reflective of the stage at which these kinds of features might get demoed for outside input. If you are just rolling it out as we already built this thing and you are the very last step where we tell you about it before we make a public announcement, then that's not really meaningfully different than doing it at the same time as the general public announcement. Ideally, you would want to have outside groups providing some sort of input early enough in the process that it could actually make a meaningful difference to the outcome. Now, it's entirely possible, and it's certainly been the case in the past, that you can do civil society consultations and then just ignore everything that they say and then, you know, still go forth and say, look, we asked, you know, stakeholders, and you know, this is what we came up with. We didn't actually follow their recommendations, but you know, we went around and talked to them and listened. I think that there are potentially some different choices that could have been made if they had talked to people from different parts of this issue. Here's where I think it's important that you recognize that civil society is not all one uniform thing, because it may be easy to say, well, we shouldn't ask the people that we know are never going to like anything we ever do, and they're just going to reflexively knee-jerk and scream about it, and therefore, you know, let's just paint everybody in civil society the same. They're not. There is an opinion piece that came out yesterday in the New York Times by Matt Green and my boss, Alex Stamos, who have very different, you know, points of view on this issue, but nevertheless agreed enough to publish an op-ed jointly in the newspaper of record saying how bad this is for privacy and proposing alternatives that could have been done instead. It, you know, one of the things that Alex says is, why couldn't you have simply decided to have this feature be turned on only for shared photo albums in iCloud? If your worry is about people who are sharing collections of CSAM with each other, why not limit it to that? Because one of the sort of potential reasons why Apple is doing this, we talked about the policy reason earlier, but one technical reason why this might be happening, and I've heard some doubt cast on this theory, is that it may be that Apple is going to move to end-to-end encrypt iCloud, which is something they have backed off from doing in the past. But if they were going to do it, that might be why you'd want to do all of this complicated, you know, on-device scanning and PSI stuff. But, you know, you could say, what if we only like left end-to-end encryption off for shared photo albums and then kept the rest of it, you know, end-to-end encrypted? And Apple has refused to comment on future plans. Like, I got to ask them point blank, like, are you going to end-to-end encrypt iCloud? Is that why you're doing this? And they said, we don't talk about future product choices. But my thinking is, if they had gone around and talked to some of the voices from across the spectrum, especially folks like Alex, who are interested in pragmatic solutions and who understand intimately the stakes on both sides of this issue with regard to the child safety portion and with regard to the privacy and the security portion, and see, you know, where people are coming from on both, then, you know, I like to think that maybe this is not the outcome that we would have reached, that it might have been something that looks a little more modest. You know, as lawyers, we talk about, you know, what is the most narrowly tailored solution for a particular issue? And I think there's concern that this is not the most narrowly tailored way of going about accomplishing the goals that they were trying to do. I recognize that they could have done something much broader and that this is their version of narrow tailoring, but, you know, I'm going to bring in the other side of this, but my position is kind of similar here, is could you not have just done this for shared photo albums for the CSAM scanning side? And then why aren't you building in a better abuse reporting tool into iMessage on the iMessage side? They're still not doing that. They have this parental notification thing that they're doing, but they're not, you know, they're still stopping up their ears against wanting to actually get reports to Apple about what is going on in iMessage.
Just to add on top of Rihanna's excellent points about Apple not meaningfully talking with folks, I don't know that they've ever actually meaningfully listened to folks either, which is an even easier bar, right? Like Rihanna and her colleagues at the Stanford Internet Observatory have run all sorts of great workshops on all aspects of balancing privacy and security interests in the digital world. And to my knowledge, and Rihanna could tell me if I'm wrong, I don't believe they've ever been Apple representatives even in the room listening to other folks there.
That's right. And, you know, this is something that Alex has griped about. We've had so many folks from all different parts of society. You know, the first one of these workshops that we did, which was about child safety in an end-to-end encrypted world, we had people from NCMEC, from Thorn, which is a prominent child safety tooling organization. We had the FBI. We had people from the ACLU. We had the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We had all of these different people that I think it might otherwise be pretty difficult to get to come into a room and talk civilly to each other and listen to each other. And Apple wasn't there. Now, it's fine that they didn't come to my little party or any of the other little parties that we threw in person and then virtually in the intervening time since then. But at least, you know, I think it was incumbent upon them to try and talk to people individually, even if they didn't want to come and be in the same room as us. And so, yeah, that also grates a little bit, is that there has been great work that is extremely pertinent to this that has been coming out all along, both on the social and the policy side, but also on the technical side. You know, Jonathan Mayer has a paper out at Usenix this week that is extremely relevant and extremely similar to what Apple's proposing. And that's been in the works for a while. He put out an earlier version of that around the same time as we started holding these workshops in late 2019. And an important component of that paper that's at Usenix this week is saying, here's a design that you could implement. Here are the really serious reasons why you should consider not doing this because of the civil liberties and human rights impact and because of the potential for government abuse, which is something I'm sure we'll get into shortly.
Rihanna, I just want to emphasize that I would always come to a party that you threw if you invited me. So just keep that in mind for the future. I would never pull an Apple on you.
You know what they say, there ain't no party like a West Coast party, because the West Coast party don't stop.
That is what they say.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly. And then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
So we will definitely talk about the worries about government abuse. But before we do that, I want to turn back to Mayank, and I want to, you know, get a sense from you of what the response has been from the technical community. So Rihanna gave us a sense of what at least certain parts of digital civil society think about this. And I'm curious, what do the technologists, the cryptographers, the security researchers, what do they think about this issue? And in particular, I was hoping you could talk about this issue of client-side scanning. So one thing that I've been reading about is that a lot of the controversy around this new system is that it doesn't operate on Apple servers. It actually operates on the iPhone device itself, and that this is, whether it's new, it is at least controversial. So why is that? And what else do the tech people, as it were, think about this new system?
Sure. The response from the tech community includes everything that Rihanna just said. I mean, people who go into cybersecurity or cryptography as a career usually have very strong views about digital privacy. So everything that Rihanna said. Picking on the specifics of the tech response also, there's been a variety of people taking a look at the white paper from just a cryptographic perspective to just verify that, you know, it does what it says it does. And it's, you know, not clear. You know, the what Apple has done is something relatively similar to conference peer review, in that they have a white paper designed by you know, a bunch of authors at Apple, as well as Dan Binet at Stanford. But they've also gone out and gotten some external cryptographers to review it. which is very nice. But that having been said, I think I would be petrified if any paper that I wrote at a conference, immediately I got a call from a company the next day saying, we've built this into our systems. Like, the standard of peer review is very different than the standard of, this is going to be running live on a billion people's phones. And if we mess up, there are catastrophic consequences to digital privacy. So just as Rihanna said, it would have been nice to have everyone from the civil liberties communities involved earlier in the design process. It would have been nicer to have, you know, a broader discussion in the crypto community. But beyond that, the bigger concerns for the tech community, I think, center around this, you know, black box hash function and the fact that it's interspersed into this complicated cryptographic system and the implications of a failure of this perceptual hash function on the rest of the system are not at all understood and very difficult to understand. Even if we had all the code, it would take a long time. And also, like you said in your question, sort of this shifting of the Overton window, this idea that there used to be this idea that, you know, what's run on your local machine, your local phone, your local, you know, laptop is sort of code that you approve of. And what servers do is not entirely, you know, whatever they want. Like, there are reasons to have both actual regulations and social pressures and pushback to constrain what companies do with our data and with our information. But to say that, like, at least at a minimum, what's on your device, you have full control of. Now, we're well past the point technologically that you could, like, literally write your own operating system from scratch and actually do anything to interface with anyone else in the world. But at least the idea that, you know, you have this say over how your system is used, how your, you know, that physical possession of the phone corresponds to logical control over what's going on in the phone, is sort of that's been broken here. And that's very concerning because it's not at all clear what the implications of breaking that in this one arena will have as downstream effects in many other problem domains.
Yeah, so let me follow up on that. I guess I understand conceptually the difference between what happens on your physical hardware versus what happens on hardware that other people own, right, in the cloud or somewhere else. But I guess I'm having trouble seeing why an ordinary or even a relatively technologically advanced user should care about that distinction. You know, as you point out, it's been a long time since you could actually have control over what is on your physical device, in particular with respect to iPhones, which are quite locked down. You can't install anything that Apple hasn't approved of. You know, it's been a while since it was easy to jailbreak your phone. So it doesn't actually seem that we have had control, those of us who have Apple devices, very much on what is in our pockets. And at the same time, lots of people, of course, not everyone, but lots and lots of users, including many technically sophisticated users, spend much of their life using cloud services to the extent, you know, to the point where for many of us, a phone is just kind of a thin and fairly dumb client to access our online mail, our online chat, our online browsing, our online streaming, our, you know, everything is online. And so are there actual technical and actual security implications, novel security implications of Apple doing this scanning on the user device? Or does this just make more salient a fact that has been true for many, many years now, which is that the idea that you somehow own that, or that when you own a Apple device, you actually have control over it, that which has not been true for many years now is just more obvious to everyone?
So the way I would respond to that is to say that, you know, if everything that Apple says works correctly, that's a big if. If we assume also what Rihanna was saying earlier, that, you know, Apple will move to a world where iCloud is otherwise end-to-end encrypted, there is a real possibility that the privacy of your data would be better than in a world where there's server-side scanning everywhere. But that if is like a big statement that we do not understand at all, and the implications of failure of everything to be working properly, you know, at best leads to a false sense of security. And at worst, could open up even new failure modes that we haven't thought of yet, because it's only been, you know, a week since this has been announced publicly. So that's part of the concern. And that adds on top of the statements I was saying earlier about, you know, this idea of local device control. It's true that, you know, we don't have the ability to just, you know, design our own computers from scratch nowadays. But it's also true that perceptions of the public opinion of tech companies and actions that tech companies take are very correlated with how the companies act in a way that is or is not in your own interest, right? So when companies made the move five, six years ago towards pushing for end-to-end encryption, both locally and for cloud storage systems, you know, that's something that is in most consumers' interest as well. So they like companies that do this. Companies that obtain that run websites that have, you know, massive trackers everywhere so that they can do lots of data mining, that might be in the company's interest. It might help them out financially, but it's not in your interest. People's perceptions of companies and their products is correlated with what they would have wanted the product to be, even if you don't have the ability to go tinker with it yourself.
Before we talk about some of the broader issues, I do want to spend another minute or two talking about these failure modes, as you describe them, Mayank. And of course, this is still very early on. People are still figuring out, you know, what is the possible parade of horribles here. But what are the concerns from a technical perspective, right? Is it that the system will be inaccurate, that it'll be false positives or false negatives? Is it that this creates a vulnerability that can somehow be hacked? And what does that mean? So, you know, can you give us just a general sense of, at least right now, what are the main categories of failure that people are starting to get worried about based on what we know about the system?
So I can give some answers, but I'll caution that the whole purpose of having an open peer public review and process that Rihanna was talking about earlier is that, you know, none of us can think of all the possible ways, none of us individually can think of all the possible ways something can go wrong. And that's why the security and privacy community is a community that looks at these kinds of challenging problems together. But some of the concerns concretely that have been raised are about, can you fool this perceptual hash function? So can I change an image that maybe actually is CSAM into a way that it evades detection? And then CSAM peddlers can go on and share all this child abuse material, or conversely, send you innocuous looking things that look like a totally fine, you know, image to you, but that the detectors will pick up as abusive material. Can I use this for some kind of way to blackmail or extort you? This is all assuming, I mean, right now, this system is just planning to be rolled out in the United States, where the downstream implications of this technology matching you are that Apple sees something and may or may not report it to NCMEC, who may or may not report it to the law enforcement agencies, you know, depending on their manual reviews. But how this system is used in other countries could be very different, and that the way that different societies choose to use this technology, potentially very different than the way that the U.S. does, will interface with the ways that these technical failure possibilities, it might exacerbate how bad they could become.
Yeah, so let's turn to that. And let me ask you, Rihanna, you know, beyond the issue of Apple not consulting civil society, I mean, there are obviously lots of substantive concerns. And I assume these concerns are not primarily with the privacy of people who have or want to share CSAM, right? These are not the people who we're concerned about. You know, what are the worries, not necessarily the technical worries, but the kind of policy worries that you and you know, other folks in civil society have about Apple's new system?
I think you're right that there has not been a lot of concern, not no concern, but very little concern expressed for the people who are trading in this unlawful material where there is zero legal context. There's no legitimate context to own it, to trade it, to transmit it, to store it. There is worry about what happens if there are false positives. What about the privacy of people whose photos are mistakenly flagged because of some image perturbations or something that happen to their images that get it, you know, ensnared in you know, some sort of false match against the hash database for enough of the images on their device that it trips the secret threshold that we're talking about. That's one thing. And so I know that's also a technical concern, is how likely is that to happen? Apple says it's one in a trillion. We don't know, I don't think, what they're basing that on. There's a lot of concern about how readily this can and will be exported from the CSAM context to any kind of other content that governments around the world have some reason to dislike. I think you mentioned terrorism earlier. So we don't have a lot of hash databases just packed up and ready to go for a lot of different kinds of content out there. But one of the ones that does exist is the GIFCT database of terrorist and violent extremist content, which unlike the NCMEC database, which is managed by NCMEC, is an industry collaborative effort where there are contributions being made by multiple tech companies of what is supposedly just, you know, content that is so bad that they will take it off of their services if it is found as in violation of their terms of service or applicable local law, such as in Australia. But even there, the GIFCT database and the people who run it, the consortium that runs it, have been criticized for how opaque it is. There are very good reasons to understand why nobody should get to peek inside the NCMEC hash database. And we have to sort of take NCMEC's word for it that it has been verified as images of child sexual abuse, relating to child sexual abuse. When it comes to terrorism, because every other context other than CSAM has some sort of legitimate context for it, whether that's news or commentary or counter-propaganda, counter-programming, or human rights abuse documentation that's especially pertinent in the terrorism context, then there are worries that there are going to be databases that governments will hand to Apple and say, you also have to do hash matching on device for these other things. And even for terrorism, where you might be like, well, that seems like a pretty, you know, open and shut case, because there are these other valid contexts, and because that has already arisen as a concern just for the GIFCT database, you can see it going from there. So the worry is that the next demand is going to be GIFCT, and from there it's going to be copyright, some system similar to like what Content ID does for YouTube uploads. And that from there it's going to be deepfakes and lèse majesté and, you know, any context you could think of. There are plenty of countries where it's still illegal to be gay. So, you know, are they going to try and look for indicators that somebody's breaking that particular law? These are the concerns that have been raised, is that there are inevitably going to be free expression as well as, you know, necessarily privacy, because you are like, intruding upon people's communications and upon what people store in their private files, that there are going to be these ramifications, and that all we've heard from Apple is that if they were ever asked to do this for anything other than CSAM, they would just say no. And it's really hard to ask the owners of the billion iPhones, you know, in deployment in the field today to just rely on that as being good enough.
And so, Mayank, let me ask you a follow-up on that. So Rihanna, I think, very correctly points out that, you know, if we're in a situation in which the only thing keeping Apple from acceding to demands to search for what we think of as very legitimate or should be protected content, if the only thing we have to rely on is Apple's word, that seems like a real problem. I mean, is there any way in which Apple could design actual technical restrictions on its own ability to expand the scope of this system from CSAM, which I think we can all agree is bad content and would be good to get rid of if we could, to stuff in which there are, you know, either corner cases such as terrorism context or stuff which is just we should be protecting, but that, you know, some authoritarian governments don't want to protect. Or, you know, once you've created a system like this, whether it's CSAM or something else, is just entirely up to Apple and the powers that be to decide.
So yes and no. There are aspects of public auditability and accountability that technology could help to enforce, and there's other aspects that are not. If Apple deploys the current system as it's currently written on their website, some things that they could build mechanisms for allowing everyone to audit are, for example, does everybody get matched against the same set of images, right? Like whatever the database is that is claimed to be the NCMEC database, am I getting the same comparison as you are, or is somebody trying to target me? You could actually build a mechanism to detect that. There's also the ability to say, have potentially, if there's a third party who could serve as an auditor who's authorized to view this images, which is almost nobody in the United States for the reasons Rihanna said, then you could have other people attest to the fact that you're being served the right set of images. But all of those kinds of technological mechanisms would require specific code to be on your client device, your phone or laptop, that would perform that check and that would say refuse to participate in the protocol if this accountability check is broken. But remember, Apple controls that local device code, right? I mean, they always have. That's not a new property of anything this week, but they control that code. And, you know, they're sort of opening the box of saying, we're willing to tinker with client-side code for these kinds of purposes. And who's to say they don't just turn off, you know, this kind of check and validating something like that they, you know, they didn't tamper with your own client code is something that's virtually impossible technologically for, you know, you as a device owner to validate that the operating system manufacturer itself, you know, the company that makes both the hardware and the software isn't doing something nefarious. There's really nothing you can do about it technologically. And as a result, I wish, you know, we would have seen a lot more transparency in their website and their interviews and all about not just, you know, here's a cryptographic idea. In some sense, that was like the easiest part of this very complicated problem, and that they should have been doing more upfront, expecting the very, very reasonable questions that people like Rihanna are asking.
So let's situate this in the larger set of conversations that in some sense have been going on since the 90s, but really got going, you know, in the last 10 years about access to encrypted data, right? This is the quote unquote going dark debate. And it does seem to me, and I want to get both of your thoughts, but I'll start with you, Rihanna. It does seem to me that one of the most dramatic effects of what Apple has done is that it sort of does seem to have conceded a certain kind of defeat in its position in the going dark debate. You know, so a very kind of stylized and caricatured, you know, description of both sides was that the tech industry and Apple in particular, but lots of folks in the tech community would say things like, look, we have end-to-end encryption. It's incredibly hard to have secure systems. It's hard enough to have that. You know, we cannot create exceptions to that without really undermining security overall. And so please, governments, stop asking us to do so, right? It's not worth it. You're not going to get a good result. And the government, you know, the FBI and other folks would say things like, look, you guys are the smartest people on the planet. You've invented these amazing things. Can you just try a little harder? Please just do a little more research. And maybe you'll discover that there's a way that at least in this or that circumstance, you can provide us with access to certain kinds of content while still having a system that overall is secure enough, right? Now, whatever you think about the security or propriety of Apple's new scanning system, it does seem to me, at least, that Apple has implicitly conceded the thing the FBI has been saying all along, which is that they're really smart. They think they're really smart. And they think that with enough research, they can come up with, at least for certain categories of data, certain categories of encrypted information, ways of providing access that they think is still overall privacy protective. And so whether or not, you know, the government side, quote unquote, has won the going dark debate, hasn't Apple kind of conceded that they have in this, or am I off base?
Well, maybe my aunt can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that this isn't some masterful brand new breakthrough in technology. It's long been known that you could do client-side scanning against hashes in a data set, and that you could make the number of matches meet a particular chosen threshold. Like, Apple did not invent private set intersection or threshold encryption. But, you know, there are such obvious reasons why this might be a bad idea. And those are, again, going back to the Jonathan Mayer Usenix paper, you know, he describes a similar system and he describes the reasons why it's a bad idea. And here it is with that coming out mere days after Apple's idea came out. So, you know, I agree that they have a lot of smart people at Apple who were working hard on implementing this, but they didn't invent sliced bread here. You know, these have been some known systems and known things that you could do for a while here. And, you know, I do agree with you, though, that there has been year after year of this nerd harder thing. And honestly, like, Silicon Valley has kind of brought that upon themselves to some degree. When you're out there trying to make your share price go up as a publicly traded company and sell units as a publicly traded company, or when you're trying to raise, you know, your Series A or B or C round funding as a private company that's a startup, of course you have an incentive to say, we are the wizard geniuses, look at our wizardry. So then, you know, your bluff gets called when it's like, if you're such wizards, come up with a way of solving this problem. You know, the government's line has been, look, we were able to put a man on the moon. And, you know, Matt Blaze's response, another cryptographer, has been, that doesn't mean it's a good idea to put a man on the sun. But, you know, just to push back on the idea that this is a brand new breakthrough design. But Mayank, maybe you can tell me whether that is correct or not.
I agree. The components of this system are all things that have been known before. Probably the newest part is also the least relevant to any sort of policy debate part, which is that obfuscation piece that I mentioned at the end, which uses this brand new thing called detectable hash functions. It really doesn't matter what it is. It's pretty cool to people like me, but fortunately, it's not the main part that matters here. I think in terms of the sort of broader question of going dark and does this resolve or change much, I think from a technological standpoint, no, for the reasons Rihanna stated. And there's a big difference between here's a specific scientific problem. Can you search for CSAM on photos uploaded to iCloud? It's a very well-defined problem, and it's a problem where you know exactly what you're looking for, and you knew what you were looking for before you started searching, right? You have the NCMEC has the set of images before you start doing scanning, whether server-side or client-side. It's a very scoped and well-defined problem. Versus, you know, when there are these conversations about the going dark debate, I don't even know what law enforcement is asking for. They just want the ability to do anything all the time, and they will figure out at some point what they want to be looking for on which devices. And the tech has to be able to sort of, you know, have the clairvoyance to figure out what police might do in the future and to prepare for that possibility. That's not the way technologically that anything works, to say nothing about the giant policy leap that it's.
Let me try to ask the question a different way. So I take both of your points that first, Apple may not have in fact solved this problem in the sense that this may not be a good idea. And even if this turns out to be an okay idea, and this is tolerable from a security and privacy perspective, it doesn't mean that Apple can solve the other problems that law enforcement wants it to solve, because the going dark problem is not actually one technological problem. It's many only sort of related technological problems, and what works for one of those problems may not work for another one of those problems. But in terms of the kind of the war of ideas around this, doesn't this make your lives harder, right? So you know, the relationship between the civil society that Rihanna is part of, the academic community that Mayank is part of, industry that Apple is part of, and the government that, you know, the FBI is part of, that has always been a very complicated relationship. And in the last 10 years or so, the civil society and the academic research community has tended to be allied with big companies like Apple in all pushing back against demands from the government to, you know, quote unquote, do something about the going dark issue. And presumably the fact that the really smart people at Apple were saying, we can't do this, made it easier for a Rihanna or a Mayank to point to that and say, no, look, they can't do this, so please stop asking. Now, doesn't it make your life much harder now that Apple has done this thing to say, and there's consensus, not just among us academics or us civil society people, but among the actual industry folks that you would need to build you the magic system, that this can't be done, because Apple has just admitted that at least for a non-trivial part of the problem, it can be done, at least according to Apple. I mean, so let me ask you, Rihanna, you know, do you think this makes your life that much harder as you go forth and try to continue your fight against any attempts to weaken, as you understand it, in encryption?
Absolutely. And first, let me push back on your formulation. It's not that Apple or anybody else was saying this can't be done. It's that we're saying this can't be done safely, or this can't be done securely. And Mayank has been speaking to the concerns and the doubts about whether this is actually as secure as Apple's asking us to think that it is. And I've pointed out some of the concerns around why this is not something that can be done without a blast radius that affects anybody from, closeted queer kids in Iowa up through, human rights and vulnerable populations around the world. So, you know, it's not about like the technology, it's kind of about the applications of the technology. Every technical choice is also a policy choice. And so, yes, this does make my job harder, in as much as Apple has made this decision. And immediately we have seen government officials, for example, in the UK saying, great, now it's Facebook's turn, now it's Google's turn, everybody else should be doing the same thing. And, you know, this is despite the fact that these dangers were already well understood, and that the risks were well understood, and that we have not been quiet about re-raising those concerns now that Apple has dropped this into the laps, not only of their users, but of every other company out there, and all of those companies' users. And, you know, all eyes have been, you know, deflected away. The thing that I think Apple might be thinking is that this is going to get the government off their backs. Look, we gave you what you want. Now, like, this is the thing that you keep hammering on us about. Now we've done it, go away. It's not. Now it's going to be, they're all going to be wanting one. And it's not, as I said, going to be limited to CSAM. So I don't think Apple has succeeded in deflecting attention away, even though there is also now attention being paid to the Facebooks and the Googles and the Signals of the world. It's going to be paid on Apple too. And the demand is going to be to do more and more and more. You can't give an inch without a mile being snatched away.
Mayank, let me ask you a version of the question I asked Rihanna, and let me do it by reference to something that Charles Wright, who is a security researcher at Portland State University and someone that we've both collaborated with, something that he wrote about on Twitter recently in the wake of this news. And he's been someone who's been doing research on the whether you can do scanning of encrypted information in a way that's still safe and privacy preserving. And he wrote a thread in which he expressed a lot of his frustration about how, in his view, the security research community has not been willing over the past several years to think about ways to develop these kind of privacy protective content scanning systems. And that the result of kind of the blanket refusal to do that has meant that when inevitably someone caved to the pressure and created such a system like Apple just did, they did so without the benefit of years and years of research from the community into how to do this well. And that what you get is this system, which Charles has his own security objections to. And I'm curious, do you think that this is a kind of a fair criticism of the security research community? And if so, will this action by Apple, because it opens the door to many more such attempts by Apple or other companies or other governments to create scanning of encrypted data, do you think this will be a wake-up call for the research community to actually start taking this issue more seriously and actually be willing to do a lot more research into this?
Yes, I think Charles's criticism is valid. And yes, I think or hope that there would be some changes in the way that academic cryptography and cybersecurity communities look at these problems, which is to say that there's sort of questions about what subset of the going dark, or whatever you want to call it, problems are technologically possible versus what subset are actually good ideas for society. And I worry that the cryptographers tend to conflate the two. And like we've been discussing this whole time, the tech that Apple is talking about is not new. And so there could have been discussion over the past decades. I mean, the technology of private set intersection goes back to the 1980s. There could have been discussions within the tech community about where should or should not this technology be used. And there aren't, partially because maybe just structurally the way that computer science research is valued, it's based on novelty of math or algorithmic or engineering ideas. It's not really based as much on, here's a policy position paper on how my new tech should be used. That's not something that computer science venues publish. It is something that like lawyers and political scientists and economists and whatever publish, but it's not something that we do. And it's partially, I don't know, just a view that, if nobody thinks or looks at how to solve a problem technologically, maybe the requests from government will just go away. And I don't like that way of looking at it. I much prefer the way that, for example, Jonathan Mayer does, which Rihanna has mentioned earlier, that, let's understand the fundamental limits of perceptual hashing, or the way that Matt Green and Gabe Kapchuk and Giles Van Leer did in a Eurocrypt paper earlier this year, where they looked at, what subsets of the going dark problem are actually easier or harder from a technical point of view, not from a, again, we should give ourselves the freedom as a computer science group to understand what are the technological limits, even as we also, when we put our, human rights, civil privacy hats on, argue for whether they should or should not be done. But we shouldn't use that to sort of leave a complete vacuum into which, one day some company decides to drop this product and say, okay, we've solved all these problems, because then we've abdicated also our role in evaluating it.
So, I have to push back on that. And I have to push back on Charles's snit that he threw on Twitter. Like, you've just mentioned at least two papers that do exist that Charles is pretending like don't. Like, you guys published this paper that he was talking about in EuroSNP. You published it at Usenix Enigma. I saw you present it at Crypto 2018 in Santa Barbara. At that same workshop, I saw Stefan Savage present his work that was also trying to address a part of the going dark problem, which he later published at ACM CCS. There's been a lot of other academic publications on different ways to try and do accountability within different systems. And like, it's out there. And the fact that, you know, maybe a lot of computer scientists have decided to work on problems besides solving law enforcement's problems for it is not evidence of the fact that, like, no, everybody's decided that this is just a verboten research area. In addition to which, like, if you are required by reviewers to think about and say something about the potential impacts societally or policy-wise of the thing that you're proposing, you know, that's, I think, a valid amount of pushback. I think there's a lot of debate to be had over, you know, the role of ethics or legality in terms of what systems get proposed in academic works. But, you know, frankly, Charles sounded like Josh Hawley whining about getting his book deal pulled. The fact that you didn't get to publish something in your venue of choice, in your particular conference proceedings of choice, does not mean that you can't get your ideas out there and publish them. The Keys Under Doormats paper from the MIT team was published months before they published it in the various outlets that they published it in. And that is extremely highly regarded and still kind of a classic in this field of describing what the issue is and what the potential implications are. It's not as though it was impossible to put your work out there if you had some idea that you thought would be, you know, no-no'd by the, you know, naysayers within the academic community who didn't want you to do your work on how to help out law enforcement and achieve these goals that they have that are entirely legitimate goals. But like, the way that he went about saying this was weirdly victim blaming. It's as though, you know, like if a state government had said, we're looking for the, you know, the most humane way to put a prisoner to death. Can you help us out? We're putting out a CFP. And some people say, here's a proposal for a particular drug cocktail that we think would be not painful and would be like quick and you know, relatively humane. And a group of doctors say it violates the Hippocratic Oath to assist in any way with executions. Then when, you know, the state comes out and says, all right, we're going to do the firing squad, it's really unfair for the people who propose the drug cocktail to turn around and say, look what you made them do by saying that it violates the Hippocratic Oath. It's just not true.
Yeah, just in quick response. So I don't think Charles was saying, you know, he was sad about, you know, which venue our paper got published or that everybody in the, you know, cybersecurity community should like rush and want to publish papers in this area. I think the question is more, you know, how open is the community to thinking about this problem? You know, at the workshop that Rihanna, you that were describing earlier that we both attended associated with Crypto 2018, there was a good contingency of people continuously asking questions every 15 or 30 minutes, like, why are we here? Why does this, you know, venue even exist to be thinking about these kinds of questions? And that's the part that I'm referring to, at least that I believe Charles was saying as well, that if we have an attitude of, if we all stick our head in the sand, this will go away, that's not necessarily as productive as let's have the discussion of both what is technologically possible and not, and also what is good for society or not. So I think the point was just to say, let's have more dialogue about this within the computer science tech community, not less.
So obviously this is going to be an issue we're going to be talking about for a long, long time. So I think we should end it there for now. Rihanna, Mayank, thank you very much for joining me and really appreciate your thinking and writing and work on this issue.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you've liked what you've heard, please take a moment to rate the podcast or let someone know so they can enjoy it as well. This podcast is produced by Jen Patya Howell. Hamza Shittu of Goat Rodeo is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.